It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. In a normal year, there would be millions of people all over the planet in transit right now, packed into planes and cars, taking trips, commuting to work, going on vacation, a constant hum of human migration. And thanks to the pandemic, a lot of that has come to a halt. But in our stillness, there's an opportunity to notice how much other migration is still going on, has always been going on, all around us. Billions of animals, birds, reptiles, fish, and insects travel vast distances every year, moving with the seasons, guided by the stars, the geographic cycle of life. Maybe it's time we paid more attention.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we move on?
Yep.
Yeah.
Last year, when we could still travel, Steve and I went on a short safari in the Serengeti wilderness.
You know, safari is a Swahili word for journey. We wish you good journey. That's what the safari jema.
Our guide is naturalist Moses Augustino Kumburu. He's the founder of Moax Safaris in Tanzania. And he knows the Serengeti the way we know our backyard, even in the rain.
Can I pause to comment on your superior driving skills?
Yeah.
Well, I would be so nervous driving here.
The road slippery. Is totally mud.
Yeah, and this kind of soil, the black cotton soil, it's very slippery when it gets wet like now.
What happens if you get stuck?
You push.
Push.
Yeah. Oh, are you okay yet?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Just hold on.
That's fine.
That was dramatic.
The Serengeti is the home of the largest animal migration in the world. 2 to 3 million wildebeest, zebras, and gazelles travel every year between here and the Masai Mara in Kenya. And on the way, they pass through the Ngorongoro crater, which is this enormous grassland inside the caldera of an extinct volcano.
So now we are on the floor of the crater, which is 19 kilometers wide. Uh-huh. So this is like the, you know, the story in the Bible, the Noah's Ark. So this is really like the Noah's Ark, because all kinds of animals are here. It's really, really amazing to see.
It is unutterably beautiful.
Yeah.
The sun is just rising.
Exactly.
The grasses are all still covered with dew, and as far as you can see, they're just dotted with animals.
Yeah, these are, see here, the Thompson gazelles. I see the wildebeest, I see the grand gazelle, I see the jackals over there. Thousands of animals here in the crater. This is a magical place, you know.
It's like seeing the dawn of creation.
Exactly. But you never know, in the grasses here, there are a lot of dangerous stuff here, like lions, leopards. We just don't see them, but for sure they see us.
Mm.
So that's why it's not advisable to just wander in Serengeti, walking in the tall bushes, you know.
I know. I keep asking you if we can stop and walk.
I know.
And you keep saying no.
Yeah, so you never know. You never know. So the name of these ones here are called the white-beard wildebeest. Or sometimes the other name of these, they're called gnu, because of their sound. Gnu, you know. That's why they're also called gnu.
This is part of the Great Migration?
Yeah, this is part of the Great Migration. So now they're heading to the east side of the Serengeti to join the bigger herd there. That is where they give birth. Once they start, they'll all drop the babies like crazy, you know?
Yeah. Why do they migrate?
Because the ground in that area, it has a lot of calcium. Calcium is very good for the animals, you know. It strengthens the bones.
Yeah, calcium. So, and it must be good for the mothers who are then going to nurse the babies.
Exactly. So the milk will be very nutritious for the babies. And also in that area where they're heading, it's a short grass, so it's very safe for the babies because they can see any predator coming.
So if you look way in the distance there,
another huge long line.
Wow. Oh, yeah. How do they know from generation to generation? How do they know which route to follow?
Yeah, it's instinctive, you know, instinctive.
Are they always in some part of the migration?
Yeah, they're always in the move. Almost 2.5 million animals moving according to the time of the year, you know.
It's just incredible to see them just walking. They're not going fast, they're not going slow, it's just they're just pacing steadily, mile after mile. Wow.
I think it's really one of the wonders of nature.
They say they see the a leopard in the grass here.
A leopard? Moving on. No leopard.
Very elusive animal.
Yeah.
Zebras are over there. Zebras.
Oh, yeah. There's a bigger question to ask here. Why do animals migrate? The Serengeti's Great Migration is just one of many. And conservation biologist David Wilcove says the scale is staggering, but that climate change is putting some of these journeys at risk.
The mind-boggling thing about migration is that it happens everywhere on the planet, that there are animals. It involves all types of animals, from bumblebees to elephants. And it's a critically important phenomenon, both for the environment and also, I think, for human welfare and human enjoyment of the world.
And it's worth pointing out that, as you say, all these different kinds of animal species do this. Some do it over land. Some do it, birds and bumblebees, monarch butterflies, fly many miles through the air. Whales and sea turtles do it through the ocean. Salmon swim up rivers. It's kind of extraordinary just how it cuts across the animal world.
Very much so. It's hard to think of any major group of animals where there aren't migratory species. The migrations themselves may differ dramatically. It may be a relatively short migration of moving down a mountain for the winter, or it may be a migration that crosses continents.
So why? Because there are obvious risks involved. I mean, physically, it's taxing to travel all this distance. There are a lot of dangers. What are the benefits?
There are definitely risks. And if the benefits didn't exceed the risks, then migration wouldn't persist as a phenomenon. My belief is that most animal migrations are really an example of opportunism. It's taking advantage of a food resource that's available for a part of the year that then disappears later on in the year. So the classic example is the North Woods. They are filled with insects during the spring and summer. If you're an insect-eating bird, it's a great place to raise a family. But you better be out of there by the time the cold weather comes in.
So basically, in most cases, it's chasing after the food, where the food's available. So if there is a hall of fame of migratory species, certain extraordinary animals, what would be a few of those animals that you would point to?
Well, the oft-cited champion for long-distance migration is the Arctic tern, which literally travels from the Arctic Circle down to the Antarctic and back up again. So it spends most of its life traveling. It's a remarkable journey. There's another tern, the sooty tern, where the young hatch and then they go to sea for about 4 or 5 years, perhaps, before they return as breeding birds. And you never see sooty terns perched on driftwood or other debris in the ocean. And scientists think they may actually stay on the wing continuously for several years before they come back to breathe.
I'm just trying to imagine, like, how they have the energy to do that. Obviously, they're sleeping as they fly.
It's a great question. Now, one of the things we have learned about bird migration is that the energetics of it are complicated, but perhaps it's not as costly an activity as we might have thought. There's a German scientist, Martin Wichelski, who studied migrating thrushes in the Midwestern United States. And he found that they actually expend about the same amount of energy migrating in a given night as they would expend if they were just huddled down in the woodlot for the evening and not migrating. Because really? It was getting cold and it was taking a fair amount of energy to stay warm. And we do know that birds will take advantage of thermals and other things to sort of make the journey a little bit easier.
Yeah. We've been talking about the glory of animal migrations. Truly one of the great spectacles in the world. You have also written that a number of these migrations are in decline, especially some of the mass migrations, and some of the habitats are disappearing. How serious a problem is this?
Well, I think almost all of the great animal migrations are in trouble, and a lot of the great ones have disappeared completely. We don't have the great herds of bison that we had 200 years ago, the flocks of passenger pigeons that darken the skies in the colonial era. Gone completely.
And we should put this in perspective. So everyone has heard that the passenger pigeon has gone extinct. What we may not realize is how common these birds once were.
They were so common that their migrations lasted over a period of several days and put the land over which they were migrating in this sort of eerie, unnatural twilight because they were so common that they darkened the skies and somewhat obscured the sun. That's how abundant they were.
You're talking about hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of birds.
Hundreds of millions.
Hundreds of millions.
Yes.
At one time.
It was at one time probably the most abundant bird in the world.
It's astonishing to think that that bird could then disappear, could go extinct.
September 1st, 1914, the very last one died in captivity.
Just because people shot them?
Largely due to that. It was a combination of this sort of ruthless overexploitation for the market, combined with the wholesale clearing of forests, compounded by the fact that even though this was an incredibly abundant bird, this huge population only nested in a few places. These were enormous nesting colonies, but they were discrete, and so the hunters could disrupt each and every one of them. And that's more or less what happened. And in a surprisingly short period of time, the birds were snuffed out.
Hmm. And that's, I suppose, the species that are especially at risk. The migratory species are those that go to a particular place, the monarch butterflies, who are flying down from North America in the winter and go to this one part of central Mexico, this mountainous forest.
That's right. When these species aggregate in a few discrete spots, it's frighteningly easy to destroy their populations by destroying those spots. Of course, the paradox is it's also relatively straightforward to conserve them because you know precisely the places to protect them. But the unfortunate thing is around the world, the great animal migrations are disappearing. The populations of songbirds in eastern North America are down anywhere from 50 to 75% over the past half century.
Why is that?
Largely due to a combination of habitat loss in North America, as well as in the Caribbean and Central America, where many of these birds winter. We've seen salmon runs decline in the Pacific Northwest over the past century, largely due to the great dam projects, which certainly brought huge benefits to people in the Pacific Northwest. There's no doubt about it. But it also snuffed out these extraordinary salmon run.
So you can understand that as human development just keeps increasing around the world, there are fewer wild places, certain habitats are destroyed, forests are cleared. It sounds kind of just like this unrelenting horror story, but is it quite that bad?
It's a bad situation, but it's by no means a hopeless situation. And you do see increasing efforts to protect some of the great animal migrations. So just within the United States, for example, the discovery of some long-distance pronghorn antelope migrations within the past 10, 15 years prompted state officials to work together to protect the migratory routes.
How do you do that?
You ensure that people don't block the key pinch points of the migration with fences or with development that would be hostile to the animals moving across. You basically give them a safe passageway. That's the real challenge, is that migratory animals pay no attention to the sorts of administrative boundaries that are so important to us.
Right. We might be obsessed with borders, trying to keep certain people out of another country, but that doesn't work in the animal world.
Exactly. And so it requires a level of coordination across boundaries, whether it's one state working with another state or one country working with another country. And we're slowly learning how to do that. So we can and we do take actions to protect these species. My argument would be that we have to do more.
That's David Wilcove, a conservation biologist at Princeton University, talking with Steve Paulson. I said earlier that we're looking for lessons from super navigators today. One is that life on the move is a lot more common than we tend to think. And another is that migration is a collective experience. In the Serengeti, the wildebeest lead the great migration, but they have fellow travelers, including Steve's favorite, zebras.
Look, the zebras, look, you just keep, look down there. My God, they just keep going. There are hundreds more.
It's like the great gathering of the clans, like as far as the eye can see.
Cowdens.
The white and black against the bright green grass. Oh, God, they're gorgeous.
Yeah, this is part of the migration. Remember we saw those
wildebeest
marching here? So they are all coming to join them here.
This is hundreds and hundreds of zebra.
Hundreds and hundreds, yeah, endless. You can see everywhere, the stripes everywhere, black and white. If you compare one to another on these patterns, you can see the differences. They're all different, like a fingerprint.
And why do the zebras migrate with the wildebeest?
You know, they depend each other, you know, because zebras have a very good eyesight, and these wildebeest, they have a very, very good sense of smell. So together they can be safe.
So the zebra might see a predator, and the wildebeest might smell a predator. So together that keeps them safe?
Yeah.
Do they eat the same food?
Zebras prefer tall grass, mm-hmm. and the wildebeest short grass.
So even there, they're not competing there, exactly for food.
Exactly. Even there is no competition of food. That's why they are kind of no problem of them moving together.
That's lovely, kind of this ancient kinship.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
Oh, look, they're starting to cross the road.
What is that?
The sound of zebra.
Oh my gosh, yes, three. What are they waiting for?
The vultures are also migrating with the herds.
Why? Are they waiting for somebody to drop dead?
Oh yeah, they wait. Yeah. Waiting for somebody to die or to be eaten so they can finish everything. You know, they are like housekeepers. Because they're cleaning everything, you know. After the lion or leopard or cheetah eating something, and then they come and finish everything. So that's why you don't see any dead animal or, you know, so they help to stop disease outbreak. That's why I call them housekeepers.
Because most people just scorn them.
Oh, yeah, exactly. They're playing a very, very important role here in the ecosystem. Yeah, they're very, very important.
Yeah. Zebra crossing.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's trying to decide. Can I cross?
Can I get across?
Okay, change mine.
Yeah, okay.
Because the other car was coming across. Yeah.
Coming up, you don't have to go to Africa to witness a great migration. Just look around. I'm Ann Strange Champs. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. If you live in the upper Midwest, you know that winter's on the way when you hear sandhill cranes flying overhead. Now, if you've never seen one, a sandhill crane is a tall bird with a scary sharp beak and bright red topknot, and they're one of the great conservation success stories. They were once so endangered the population was nearly wiped out. Wildlife ecologist Stan Temple is one of the people who helped bring them back by figuring out their migration pattern. So on a cold day last fall, we went with him to watch the cranes gather on a small island in the Wisconsin River before they headed south. As always with cranes, you hear them way before you see them.
The maximum number that we've had has been 14,000, and we normally have 10 to 12,000 birds in here by this time of year. And on this particular island in front of us, we've had 6,000 or 7,000 birds. It's pretty packed out there. The late arriving birds actually kind of like a plane having to go around on a runway. They have to circle a couple of times to find a bare piece of ground to land on.
The sound is amazing. Do they have different calls that they make?
This time of year, it's just like people in a large crowd. There's a din of chatter among them. Cranes produce a very loud sound. They have a very long, convoluted trachea, kind of the same effect that you have with a French horn or something, with a long passageway for the sound that it kind of amplifies it, and it comes out very loud. Yeah, I've always loved Aldo Leopold's description as the trumpet in the orchestra of evolution. It's just perfect. We really knew virtually nothing about sandhill crane migration prior to our work. And it's true of most bird migration. You know, okay, they're here today, gone tomorrow, but you don't know where they came from, you don't know where they're going, unless you can follow them, which is what my students and I did. It's how we sort of wrote the book on sandhill crane migration, is because we had radioed birds that we were able to follow and know all of the little tricks of sandhill crane migration, know when they stop, where they stop, why they stop there.
Were you following them in a plane?
We had both a plane and people on the ground in vehicles tracking them. It's not easy because the cranes are moving pretty fast. You'd get lost on the ground. The road system just didn't go in the direction the cranes were going, and you had to make some wide detours. But the plane often bailed us out.
Well, I think maybe what we're going to do, we're going to keep the windows closed until some birds hopefully start to come into our island here. Otherwise, it's going to get pretty breezy and wet in here. We'll open it up when we think we've got something really to look at. I'm just afraid that this brisk wind is going to discourage the birds from landing where they normally land on this island.
How do they know where to go?
It's pretty easy for animals to do direction, to know north from south and all. I mean, we can do that, and we're not very sophisticated at migration. By looking at the sun and the stars, we can figure out where north is. But if I give you a compass, essentially, something that will tell you direction, and I ask you to find your way to Florida, you can't do it. Just knowing the direction isn't good enough. You have to have a map. And that is something that is something that they either have inherited genetically, in the case of birds, for example, that don't migrate with their parents, that make that first migration all by themselves, they have inherited the genetic map. Birds like sandhill cranes and waterfowl that migrate on that first migration with their parents have basically been taught.
What are they even noticing? What are they picking up?
Well, it's pretty important. This is a life or death matters. So for birds that migrate at night, which is most of our small songbirds, they're navigating using the stars. But what happens when they migrate under a cloudy night? They can't see the stars. It's kind of like an airplane or NASA sending up a spacecraft. You have to have some kind of backup navigation system. And for birds, if their best, most accurate navigation system is unavailable, they will shift to the next best of their redundant systems. And the next best for some birds might be geomagnetism. They can detect it. It's not as accurate as having the stars or the sun, but you can detect it and it can at least keep you roughly on course. Others use prevailing winds, and if they're migrating along the coast, they can hear the waves crashing on the shore and know that I've got to always keep that sound to my left, and it means I'll be going in the right direction.
Probably from about that tree, you can see out this window to here a good amount that have already landed.
Oh, where?
On this left side, on the far side of the island.
So I'm guessing we're going to get some nice flybys.
I know you're a scientist, but is there something you find beautiful about migrations?
Oh, it's fascinating, of course, and it's beautiful to watch the birds doing it. Seeing them rising up in the air, hundreds or thousands of cranes circling in a thermal, is quite an impressive visual sight. And of course, as usual, they're noisy. So for most people, they know they're around because they hear the noise and they look up and hear these little tiny specks thousands of feet in the air.
Stan Temple is a wildlife ecologist at the University of Wisconsin and a senior fellow at the Aldo Leopold Foundation. We're in a golden age of animal tracking, but somehow the more we discover, the more mysterious animal migration seems. David Barry has traveled around the world, from the Australian desert to the South African bush, studying the superstars of animal migration, the species he calls super navigators. You'd be surprised how many tiny creatures have navigational skills we can only dream of.
The monarch butterfly, like a lot of other insects, and indeed other animals besides insects, has what's called a time-compensated sun compass, which sounds complicated, but it's quite simple. The insect can detect the position of the sun in the sky and can use that to maintain a steady course. Now, because the sun is constantly moving across the sky, it needs to compensate for that movement. So it actually also has an internal clock that enables it to make an allowance to compensate for the changing azimuth of the sun and keep flying straight in a broadly southwesterly direction.
Wow, so it's really got a tool, almost a tool inside its brain that we don't have, which computes both time and light.
And angle.
Simultaneously.
A remarkable thing for a creature so small with a brain the size of, well, not even a grain of rice. It's a tiny brain with only a few hundred thousand neurons in it.
But you know, reading your book, that's what comes up over and over again. Some of the tiniest creatures on the planet have some of the most remarkable navigational abilities. Like the dung beetle was discovered fairly recently. They navigate by the light of the Milky Way.
That's right. And they're not the only ones. The nocturnal dung beetle is a truly fascinating insect. And well, I should explain that what dung beetles do is they find a pile of dung and they go to the dung and they collect a piece of it and they turn it into a beautiful little sphere. And then using their rear legs, they roll this sphere away from the pile of dung to their nest where they can feed on it and lay eggs in it and what have you. And it's very important that they get away from the pile of dung as quickly as possible, because other dung beetles otherwise will mug them and take the ball of dung off them. And to go as quickly as possible, you need to go in a straight line. You don't want to go curving around and coming back to where you started. So they have to go straight. And the way they do that is they tend to use the light of the moon.
What if there's no moon?
Well, exactly. There's Eric Warrant, whom I interviewed for the book, told me a funny story. He said that they'd published the results about polarized moonlight navigation. And then a while later, they were out in the desert in South Africa doing some more research. And they were sitting around their kind of campfire having a beer. And the moon hadn't yet risen. So they thought they couldn't really do anything. And they'd laid out some dung. And then they noticed that the dung beetles were beginning to fly in. They were drawn by the smell of the dung and they were landing. And the moon hadn't risen, but they were rolling balls of dung away. And Eric and his colleague Marie were really quite alarmed, because they suddenly thought,
Maybe we got it wrong.
Maybe we don't need the moon. So then they basically looked up at the brilliantly dark night sky out on the edge of the Kalahari Desert, no light pollution, just this amazing, brilliant starlit sky. And they noticed, of course, the band of the Milky Way, hidden from most of us city dwellers, of course. They looked at each other and they said, is it possible? Could they maybe actually be using the Milky Way? And they then proceeded to perform some absolutely delightful experiments. First of all, they put some little cardboard hats on the beetles, which prevented the beetles actually seeing the night sky. And sure enough, they couldn't steer straight.
Aww.
And then they thought, well, we'd better make another experiment to see whether it's just having a hat on that upsets them. So they made transparent hats. And when the hats were transparent, they could navigate again.
There's one thing I don't understand. One of the things that always seems most mysterious to me is how many animals migrate with incredible precision to a very particular destination without ever having been there or been shown where or how to go, like sea turtles.
Yeah.
They'll hatch from eggs. There are no parents anywhere around. Nobody is going to lead them, and they swim off to the exact right island.
Yes, it is absolutely astonishing. And what we do know is that loggerhead turtles that hatch on the coast of Florida, they are definitely the most impressive magnetic navigators, because the tiny little hatchlings, they perform an extraordinary journey. They get caught up in the north flowing Gulf Stream, and then they are taken right the way around the entire North Atlantic Ocean using ocean currents. But in order to do that, they need to know which way they're facing. And Ken Lohman at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill has done wonderful experiments, which are now really part of the bedrock of animal navigation science, in which he took little hatchling turtles and altered the magnetic field around them, and he could make these little hatchlings head in different directions. And the directions in which they head seem to be, as it were, designed to enable the hatchlings to stay safely inside the current, which will bring them back to their home beaches.
It strikes me that there are a couple of reactions I have. One is to marvel at humans' ability to figure all of this out. That's extraordinary science. But the other is to really see all of this as a story about perhaps the beginning of the decline of the myth of human exceptionalism. It seems like the story that's emerging is that paradigm of animals as being not only not inferior to us, but in some ways superior.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a really important lesson that one can learn. And animal navigation studies are certainly a wonderful window onto the amazing abilities of other species. Because to be honest, although human beings are obviously brilliant in some ways, and we've developed tools that enable us to navigate with amazing precision, notably, of course, GPS. Mm-hmm. Our natural navigational abilities, unless specially cultivated, are really nothing compared to the sort of things that we've been discussing. Indigenous peoples, however, are capable of some truly astonishing feats. So if you look at the Inuit hunters of northern Canada, or the Aboriginal tribespeople of the desert regions of Australia, or, of course, Polynesian islanders, all of these indigenous peoples have truly astonishing navigational abilities, and they don't make use of maps, compasses, or indeed tools of any kind. It's all based on their senses and their natural wits.
What's an example of the way the Inuit or Pacific Islanders, what can they do that we GPS-addled brains can't?
Well, they are. Let me talk a little bit about the Pacific Islanders. The navigational specialists, because they're specially trained and selected, start at a very early age, and they are taught the precise positions on the horizon at which 32 named stars rise and set every night. And they can use those stars to maintain a steady course in any direction they choose. So that's the star compass. On top of that, however, out on the open ocean, they can also use patterns of swell. So swell is a waveform that is not produced by local winds, but it's generated by storms, often hundreds or even thousands of miles away. And these swells follow very, very regular courses across the ocean. So these navigators use the patterns of swell also as a kind of compass. They can detect the swells and they can steer by them. More remarkable, though, still, when they get close to an island target, which may be completely invisible because it's low-lying, they can also pick up the reflections of the waves from that island, and they can work out from those the direction in which to sail to get to the island.
Wow. So to make clear, this is, imagine if they would be standing on the beach of one particular island, just looking out at what to us would be just an empty, flat horizon of ocean.
Yes.
But that's not what they see.
No. And indeed, they see the ocean as being their home. But let me give this a bit of context, because I'm not talking about little journeys of 10, 20, or even 100 miles. I'm talking about journeys of, in some cases, of thousands of miles.
Wow.
And indeed, the Polynesian Voyaging Society, which was set up in the 1970s to develop these skills and sustain them, has conducted some extraordinary voyages using these traditional techniques, not just around the Pacific, but around the world. So it's a happy thing that in Polynesia, at least, these traditional indigenous skills, truly remarkable cultural artifacts that date back for thousands of years, have been not only recovered, but preserved. I'm afraid, though, that the same is not necessarily true elsewhere, and I think there are real concerns about what will happen to the equally impressive expertise of the Inuit that I mentioned, and indeed Australian Aboriginal tribes too, and many others. These are precious heirlooms of our human ancestry, and for them to be lost just because it's more convenient to press a button on a gadget would be tragic.
That's David Barry. His book is called Super Navigators, Exploring the Wonders of How Animals Find Their Way. We've been talking about animal migration as this amazing natural phenomenon. But have you ever noticed that when it comes to humans, we almost always frame migration as unnatural? Journalist Sonia Shah has been wondering about that for a very long time.
You know, I think I've always been interested in inequality.
Mm-hmm.
my parents used to take me to India, which is where they had grown up. And I used to spend my summers at my grandmother's tenement building in Mumbai, watching over the banisters at the alley below where there were people who lived on the street down there. And I would watch the little kids who looked just like me. They'd be having their bath on the street where everyone could see them, next to the cows and the people walking around and the buses and the taxis. And then I would have my bath in like a nice tiled bathroom with running water. This difference always really struck me. Why do they have to live like that, and why do I live the way I do? Growing up, I never really got a good answer to that question. My parents would say, well, it's because they don't have good jobs. And then I'd say, well, why don't they have good jobs? And they said, well, because they don't have good education. And I'd say, well, why don't they have good education? And they would say, well, because they're poor.
We'll hear more from Sonia Shah next. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Science journalist Sonia Shah has a knack for uncovering trends before they become headlines. A few years ago, she wrote a book called Pandemic, and today we're living in one. She has a new book out called The Next Great Migration, in which she makes the case that we humans are, like many animals, a migratory species. And that challenges some of our deepest beliefs about what it means to call a place home.
Migration is inherently dangerous and difficult. So why do we do it if we aren't forced to do it? Or does it take being forced to do it to happen?
I don't think we know the answers to that question. But what I try to expose in the book is that there must be huge benefits, because we know the costs, as you mentioned, are huge. I mean, we're living through some of the costs of movement right now with this pandemic. And yet what we're discovering is that there's so much movement going on right now in the present among wild species and humans, but also in the past. If you look at specific migrations, this idea that it's only propelled by catastrophe doesn't really hold up. People migrated into the remote islands of the Pacific in prehistoric times. You know, just set off from Asia in canoes, not knowing where those specks of land might be that they would land on. For a long time, there was this idea that, oh, that must have happened by mistake, because surely no one would purposely do that. But it turns out that, yes, we did it purposely, and we didn't do it purposely just once. We did it multiple times, over and over and over again. People migrated into the Tibetan Plateau in the highest reaches of the Himalayan mountains, where there's not even enough oxygen to breathe. So these are all clues, I think, that point us towards the answer to the question you're asking.
Your last book was called Pandemic, and I wanted to talk about that for a little bit. How are pandemics and migration related?
Well, roughly speaking, contagions generally are a function of animals, peoples, and microbes moving around in different ways and colliding in different ways. You know, if you look at Ebola, for example, as a virus of bats, it spills over into humans. That happens in some forest area in West Africa, and then people carry that into cities. And, you know, so we have the movement of the bats relating to the movement of the microbes, and then the people move it around. And contagion is one of the effects of our mobile planet.
What about the idea that we belong in a place, that a place is our home? Is that concept changing, or is it changed forever?
I think there's a tension there, because I think we want to belong to certain places, but at the same time, we also need to reckon with the fact that we are very mobile, and we've moved a lot over the course of our history. What we now know is that people moved out of Africa, of course, but then didn't stay put once they got to certain places. So there's this idea of like dispersal out of Africa into an uninhabited planet, and then people got to Europe and the Americas and Asia, and then they just kind of stayed there for millennia until the modern moment of migration through like fast ships and planes and all of that. But what scientists are piecing together from genetics of ancient DNA is that people moved into the Americas and then moved back into Europe and back to Africa. People went into Asia and then went to Europe and then back to Asia and then back to Africa. And it was this complicated movements were happening just like they are today, but they were happening in the deep past. And so this idea of like, where do you belong, quote unquote, is really kind of a, you know, it's an artifact of a time when we didn't think of ourselves. We didn't understand ourselves as a migratory species, a species that moves a lot.
And some of that, too, strikes me as it can be racist and xenophobic. The idea of we belong to one place, you don't belong to that place, the us and them.
You know, I trace it back to Carl Linnaeus, who was sort of the father of modern taxonomy, and he decided where everything belonged. He named the living world and thousands and thousands of species. He came up with a system for naming them. And he decided that, okay, people in Africa belong in Africa. People in Europe belong in Europe. People in Asia belong in Asia. And people in the Americas belong in Americas, to such an extent that he said they were biologically isolated from each other and biologically alien to each other, that people who lived on different continents were different subspecies of humans. And in fact, people from Africa, he said, were almost subhuman, that they were not fully Homo sapiens, but the hybrid product of Homo sapiens and this other species of humanoids called troglodytes. And we see that idea of people of African descent as subhuman to this day with the killing of George Floyd. I mean, that was the first thing I thought of. When you look at that, the man's face as he has his knee on this other person's neck, and he has this nonchalant expression and his hands are in his pockets. And, you know, it's very much like he doesn't think that person under his knee is fully human. And that is a very old idea. And we see it, it's still so alive in our politics to this day.
How can we move on from that? What can we do?
I think part of the understanding ourselves as having a shared humanity means that we're going to have to recover our lost history of migration and the ways we are all connected. So the white nationalists, for example, they have this thing where they chug milk. That's like a big sort of white supremacy thing. And they get together and they chug milk. And it's supposed to indicate that they're Europeans and only Europeans are able to digest milk because they have a special gene that allows them to do that. But what they forget is that same gene exists in nomadic people from parts of Africa, from parts of the Middle East, camel herders. There's a number of different peoples who also have that gene. The fact is, those differences are fuzzy. They're nebulous. We do all have this shared ancestry because we have moved around. So those connections that migrants create, you know, I think that's what we need to recover. It's part of overcoming this old idea that we are naturally split into continental races that are color-coded by each continent. The black people in Africa, the white people in Europe, the yellow people in Asia, the red people in the Americas. This is what Linnaeus said, and it still is so deeply ingrained in how we think today. But science has moved on since Linnaeus, and we know that we have more in common across those boundaries of race than within them because we've all moved around so much. Whenever people move into a new place, they mix with the people who are there. We meld very easily. So the genes in migrants' bodies spread into the host populations that they enter, and that's a process that works and that is ubiquitous.
Sonia Shah is a science journalist and author of The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. She spoke with Shannon Henry Kleiber. We began this hour talking about migration as a natural wonder, something that's going on all the time, right under our noses. And we talked about wayfinding as an ability, a skill that can be learned and passed down from one generation to the next. We're all navigating unfamiliar territory these days. And so we can choose to focus on what's scary, or we can try to think of this as what humans and animals have been doing for a very long time. Moving, adapting, finding our way. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, Wisconsin at Wisconsin Public Radio by Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for joining our journey today.